The Crime Victims Movement arose out of a million cases of injustice.
Everybody's concerned about the rights of the perpetrator. No one's thinking that victims should have any rights. And we hear, treated with no dignity, no respect.
And these stories of injustice arose and they created a movement that culminated in President Reagan calling for a task force on victims of crime.
Suddenly, crime became an issue. But not only was it about crime, but it was addressing the emotional, the physical, and the financial impact.
Believing them is really important. Validating them, you know, you're not alone. It wasn't your fault.
I think the struggle for victims' rights can give meaning to the work of professionals in the field today.
Multidisciplinary teams coming together. Legislators really beginning to care about this issue.
It is those partnerships that are key and essential to the recovery of a community.
The past gives us every reason to have hope. We would be nowhere without that legacy.
And we hold on to that just as we continue to support each other and mentor that new group of advocates that are going to carry us into the future.
Before O.J.'s trial of the century was the Von Bulow case with its mix of high society, money, sex, and attempted murder charges. It was a case that drew international attention, a book, and a movie as people wondered about the fate of a beautiful heiress who lay in a coma. Now comes word that the woman at the center of it all has died. She was the socialite heiress who lapsed into a coma 28 years ago and triggered two of the most sensational trials of the 1980s. Martha Sonny Von Bulow was 47 when Rhode Island prosecutors accused her husband, Klaus, of injecting her with massive doses of insulin.
Klaus Von Bulow went on trial in Newport, Rhode Island today, charged with twice trying to murder his wife.
The allegation, he wanted to inherit Sonny's family fortune and marry his mistress. The first trial made international headlines, with Von Bulow, aristocratic and aloof, painted by prosecutors as a clever gold-digging murderer. Von Bulow sat emotionless in the courtroom as the verdict was read.
The jury finds the defendant, Klaus Von Bulow, guilty.
But it was Von Bulow's appeal that made Hollywood take notice.
Your Honors, you may not like Klaus Von Bulow.
And in a second trial, Von Bulow was acquitted.
How do you find guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Von Bulow, facing a civil suit by Sonny's two children from a previous marriage, gave up any claim to his wife's fortune, valued between $25 and $40 million, divorced her, and moved to London. Sonny Von Bulow, who never regained consciousness, lived out her days in a Manhattan nursing home, where fresh flowers were always placed at her side. Sonny Von Bulow was 76.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the advocates who try to seek justice for the victims of those crimes, just like our guest today.
And I am Renee Williams. I'm the executive director of the National Center for Victims of Crime.
Yay!
Yeah.
Welcome!
Hey,
thank you for having me.
Welcome to Real Crime Profile.
Thank you.
So I have to disclose that I am actually a new board member of the National Center for Victims of Crime. And so I am serving under Renee, her great leadership. And so one of the things we want to do is tell the world about the National Center and about the great work you're doing, Renee.
Well, and I think before we get into our work, because we're super proud of our work, but given the nature of this podcast and what you all talk about, what your listeners might be interested in knowing is that we were actually founded really out of one family's tragedy, but one of the first true crime cases that really captured America's attention, which was the Sonny Von Bulow case. So those of you who are not familiar, Sunny was this beautiful heiress whose first marriage was to a prince, and they had two children who later became our founders, Alex and Ala, who are still royalty. Unfortunately, that marriage ended in divorce, and Sunny later married this fellow named Klaus von Bülow, who, by all accounts, was an absolute scoundrel. Now, Sunny and Klaus were actually, interestingly, later played by Glenn Close and Jeremy Irons in the movie Reversal of Fortune. So Sunny and Klaus were married for about 13 years, and there were two incidents where Sunny was found unconscious. The first was in 1979, and she was revived. But then in 1980, she fell unconscious again and slipped into a persistent vegetative state, and she remained there for 24 years until she passed away in 2008. Wow. So Klaus was immediately suspected of causing this death by injecting Sunny with insulin, and he was actually convicted in his first trial, and there was boatloads of evidence against him, including multiple affairs, the fact that he was broke, and the fact that he was going for all of Sunny's money. However, he hired this guy that I know we're all familiar with named Alan Dershowitz.
Exactly.
And Alan handled his appeal and got him acquitted. That didn't sit well with Ala and Alexandra, Sunny's children. So they filed a massive civil case against Klaus, which they settled out of court, and they took that money. Well, first of all, Klaus agreed to leave the country, never to return, and give up all of his rights to Sunny's fortune, which was approximately $40 million. And Alexandra and Alex were just so disgusted with the criminal justice system and the way victims were really treated that they founded the National Center for us to advocate and help victims.
Wow, that's an amazing case, Renee. And can I pick up on just a couple of the things that you said there? First of all, I did a little bit of research before you coming on, and I wanted to understand more about Sunny, and victimology is always where we start.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it sounded to me like she was called Sunny because of her sunny nature. There was something about her disposition, wasn't there, that she was a very bright person, as in personality, and was that part of her nature?
It was. She was extremely gregarious, and she was also absolutely a stunning woman.
Right. And then, you know, why I'm curious about that is because, again, it can dictate, you know, the people that you attract. Obviously, she was very well off because she inherited money. But you mentioned the word scoundrel when you talked about Klaus. Can you just say a little bit more? And I know Jim's smiling here because he probably knows where I'm going with it. But can you say a little bit more about what you mean by scoundrel and what type of personality he had?
Well, Klaus had a bit of a shady past. By most accounts, he actually made up his last name of von Bülow to sound more aristocratic. He also was probably dirt poor, although that's not been proven, and likely married Sunny for her fortune. But even throughout their marriage, he had multiple affairs and was having an affair when Sunny died and switched mistresses mid-trial.
Right. So was there anything to suggest he was controlling as well? I mean, you talked about the fact he obviously wanted her money, and I read a lot around marital trouble and marital tensions. And whenever I hear those words, it tends to be abuse actually that was going on. Not necessarily physical abuse, but it can be coercive and controlling behavior. Because I noticed also that she did have substance abuse issues herself. And normally when you see substance abuse or misuse by someone who previously had a sunny disposition, it's normally because it's a coping mechanism because something's going on in their life that they want to remove themselves from. So these marital tensions, is there anything else known about what exactly was going on, whether there were coercive and or controlling behaviors?
I don't think it's exactly known, but highly suspected. And obviously we can't expect Hollywood to portray real life, but if you watch the movie, what they portray him as doing is almost beginning to gaslight, what we would recognize now as gaslighting, where he was the only one that could take care of her and he was telling her she was crazy. Now, obviously, nobody else was in that room except for them, so we don't know that was happening, but that's certainly the impression that is given.
Because, of course, that's called isolation. Mm-hmm. And when you isolate someone, then you can monopolize their perception. And then gaslighting happens. Yeah, control is much easier. So all these things are what we recognize in the UK as coercive control. And I, you know, it's a domestic abuse case. irrespective. And I just wondered whether the prosecutors even thought of bringing in experts to talk about domestic abuse or coercive control. Now, this isn't a criticism, by the way. It's much more about now how we understand abuse and domestic abuse, and that obviously it's not just physical stuff. The stuff that's far more damaging and insidious is the mind control. I mean, it sounds like there was possibly that going on prior to these potential injections.
Yeah. And I don't know much of what was brought into trial, but I think it's really important to remember the history of the judicial system in America. We weren't recognizing battered women syndrome really until the mid to late 80s. And on a personal note, I will say that my aunt was a victim of extreme domestic violence, and then she was later convicted of murdering her husband. And she was the first woman in Ohio to raise battered women syndrome, and it was not recognized at that time as a defense, and she was not allowed to bring it as a defense. She was only allowed to enter evidence in that she was abused in order to mitigate circumstances.
Wow, yeah. That's fascinating. I'm sorry to hear that's in your family, and unfortunately it affects so many people, but women in particular. And we did have a very high profile case in the UK of Sally Challen, very similar thing. And this case was recently in the appeals court because she was a victim from 15 to 56, but they used the coercive control law that I had campaigned for to show actually she was the victim of coercive control before she killed him. And it was because of that victimization. So actually, we don't call it battered women syndrome anymore because it's much more about the psychological, the coercive, the emotional. But there's a long history here. In America, there isn't a coercive control law. We've got it tabled on the books in New York and in California. You might be interested to know about.
Almost 5 years to the date, I was going to a concert with some friends. I woke up the next morning, the day following the concert, on my couch, still wearing the same clothes I had worn that night. And I shortly realized that they were covered in blood. And I realized that that I had been raped. What I guess I look back on about that experience was all of the help that I received, having access to the services that I've had, and having just the support network of the people who help to run those services has just given me so much strength, and it has helped me in my healing process to know that what happened that night was not my fault, that my worth and my value did not die the night of the assault. And I just couldn't have gone through the last 5 years. I wouldn't have been able to find my strength or even continue on the journey without victim services.
Renee, it might be great for Laura and the center to team up on that topic in particular, because she's recently made some real headway with the two major population centers in the country to put that at least on the radar screens of the legislature, and to get away from simply a woman or any spouse for that matter, to get away from the fact that you don't always have physical abuse. There aren't always physical signs. There aren't always hospital visits. There aren't always black eyes and bruises, but it's still just as damaging and abusive. And so hopefully our country now is going to follow the UK's lead. And who's the state senator that you're working with out here?
So Senator Rubio here in California, we've actually got coercive control law on the family law book, so it's coming that way, but we're working on the penal code as well, and it's in New York under Senator Parker. So there's lots of other states now that are very interested in it, but it's much more so that early reports can happen, that we don't wait for the physical, we don't wait for the escalation and the sexual abuse, then the stalking. And, you know, we ensure that professionals like police and others are looking for far more impact, not the physical injury, but the psychological, and we prevent that victimization at every level, because it's so costly, as you know, in terms of your aunt and families. It's the ripple on the pond throughout the whole family, but sometimes the wrong people are in prison because of it. So it's about correcting the balance, which it sounds like we might have some synergy here, some synchronicity, which, you know, the reason the center began, it sounds like, really is for this very sort of case. Right. And, you know, your founders, I'm sure, would probably be very interested to know about coercive control. And I'd be certainly interested looking at Sunny's case more, just of who she was, and then tracking her trajectory to when did the substance misuse start. Because if, again, it began when she started the relationship with Claus, then you can start to understand deterioration, particularly when someone's isolated, and you can start to understand how the behaviours manifest. But certainly when we use words like scoundrel, some of these perpetrators are very dangerous, as you know. And therefore, I always like to unpick, well, what do we mean? What sorts of things was he doing? And why was he behaving in that way? And it sounds like they got the right outcome in the end, because they got him removed from the country, and also the fact that he didn't receive any of her money. But of course, it doesn't bring their mother back. And now they're advocating via you, helping, it sounds like, many other people.
And I think the important thing to know is Klaus did live. He just passed away in 2019. So he lived out the rest of his years in Europe. I wouldn't say completely unscathed by what happened, but certainly not in prison.
The movie certainly tried to show him as being not guilty. I think it slanted quite hard.
Well, the movie was based on Alan's book.
Well, of course it was.
Book. So I think there was definitely a slant there.
And Renee, is your aunt, if I may ask, is your aunt still incarcerated, or have you been able to help her?
She is not still incarcerated. She actually received a sentence of involuntary manslaughter. So she was out after about 14 years, and then she passed away about 5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
But I will say, and we might get into this, we're doing a lot of prison reform at the National Center. And a lot of my passion there is driven by my aunt's experience. Because while she was in prison, she did take advantage of all of the things that were offered to her. So she became a licensed cosmetologist. She did people's hair. But once she got out, that stigma of being a felon was still attached to her. And she really almost became a hermit. And she was already dealing with so many issues because of the domestic violence. And she had her own drug issues as well. She was heavily addicted to drugs and alcohol. So she had her own issues as well. But once she got out, she really lost what she had found in prison. And struggled really for the rest of her life.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's so tough, because if you've been abused and controlled, you're used to one regime. Mm-hmm. And then you free your, sounds like she freed herself of that. And then she's put into another regime, more institutionalized, but she then found her way through. And then certainly with Sally and other women that I've worked with, when they're set free, it's very hard for them to know what they like, what they want, how to interact with the world when they've had most of their years being dictated to. And people don't really think about that, Renee. I think that's a really big gap in how you re-socialize, how you support, and how you advocate women post. But I would ideally like to stop them from being in those positions at the start, right? So it's prevention at the very early stage, and identifying the abuser and the abusive behavior before we get to that stage.
Yeah, Laura actually headed up the homicide prevention unit in the UK. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
I have not.
Yeah, they were actually tracking at-risk offenders as they're being released and trying to look for those kind of indicators that would indicate that they might do violence to women. And they were actually, tell her about it, Laura.
Yeah, well, we actually had 15 different programs of work. And what was also pioneering about it was all multi-agency. So it wasn't just the police. And I think that's a very different way of operating than, for example, LAPD. We worked collaboratively, and it wasn't easy, but I brought in academics and researchers. We had field intelligence officers, detectives, and we worked collaboratively across these 15 groups. But the work started with domestic violence, with the proof of concept. I created a risk model called the DASH, which allowed frontline police officers to ask the right questions of victims about coercive control and the like, which meant that we were getting in far earlier when people called us. And then we would, the high-risk offenders, we would put them on a multi-agency group, and we would problem solve the case. So some of them would be arrested, charged, go to prison, but others we would problem solve and try and find a way through with their behavior. But what it led to, and we also did domestic homicide reviews, and it led to a 58% reduction in domestic violence murders every year, which was 33 murders of domestic violence reduced every year, which is a lot when you think about, for certainly for the UK and London, 33 murders, what one would cost on average to investigate was about £1.54 million. It's now about £2 million. So we were saving money, but also saving lives. And most of our murders in London were domestic violence cases. So we were reducing the caseload because they're the cases we know the most about. So that program is now being, has been rolled out across the country. But we also had other, I had other portfolios like so-called honour-based violence and honour killings and stranger attacks on lone females and sex murders of sex workers, elderly women, contract killers, serial killers, murders committed by mentally disordered offenders. And we would analyse the murders, we would analyse the near misses and the lower level call outs, and we would put together risk models, questions that frontline officers and staff could ask, being proactive to try and prevent, not being reactive where there's nothing we can do. So it was changing the culture of policing, which ain't easy at all.
That's amazing.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I mean, I work with some incredible people, and you certainly can't do it on your own. You have to collaborate. And that's certainly what I would like to see a lot more of in the States. And now living in California, working with the senator and talking to LAPD, I think it's with Black Lives Matters and so on. There has to be this interaction with the community and listening to what the community and people's needs are, as well as victims' needs, which I, like you, I've always felt victims' needs were sort of last to ever be thought about. Everybody else's needs, and in particular perpetrators' needs, are thought about. Nothing is thought about the safety and the needs of the victims. So that's where I've spent most of my career advocating. At the front end, I still stand in classrooms. We're now virtually, and I've been training all this week virtually because I can't be in a classroom, but still helping people understand risk. I still do that, as well as working with the professionals, as well as writing. And this podcast, Real Crime Profile, which helps thousands of people all across the world. I can't even keep up with the emails and messages that we get from victims saying, well, I listened to you and then I did X. You know, I spoke out for the first time. And I really believe that's where intervention and prevention starts. So you've got to highlight risks and dangers first and be collaborative. But you've got to change the culture of policing as well, so that it's a listening culture rather than a reacting culture.
And I like what you said about that. One of the projects that we are looking to launch is actually in Los Angeles, and we've been working with the mayor's office there, which is looking at how do police within the Black Lives Matter movement and within all of the issues of police brutality, not looking at victims of police abuse, but looking at victims in underserved and minority communities. Because they don't trust the police at their core, and for good reason oftentimes. So how do we make sure that we are changing police culture where those victims have somewhere to go? So regardless of what you are a victim of, if you don't trust the police, how can you still get to them and how can police interact with you? But I agree, changing police culture, it can be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, we have to change the community culture too. It's mm-hmm. It's because it's still, I mean, I have friends who live in pretty rough neighborhoods who, when they're the victims of assault or robberies or burglaries or even attempted murder, the last thing they want to do is talk to the police about it. And of course, that frustrates the investigation. It makes it impossible to actually prosecute anybody. And this cycle just keeps on continuing. So, yeah, I was really excited about the National Center's initiative to actually look at police culture and try to change it, and from both sides of the fence.
And I will say, as far as that too, as far as the communities changing as well, it's interesting. One of our other newest board members, Kerry Watson, and he speaks pretty openly about this, so I'm not stepping on his toes by sharing his story. He's an African-American man who was the victim of a crime in that his car was broken into. This is way back in the 90s in the Rodney King era. So his car was broken into. He didn't have the money to fix it. He was a 19-year-old kid. He got pulled over by the police at gunpoint, pulled out of his car screaming, "Whose car is this?" And he's saying, "It's mine." Well, they thought that he had broken into the car. He then became a police officer and talks very openly about how he was then trained to mistrust certain, if you fit a certain profile and you filled that profile in his book, he was probably going to pull you over as well. And he talks about how it's all in the training and we have to adjust the training because it's not fair to put a label on officers if that's the way they're being trained.
And that's what Laura does. She goes out and she does a lot of trainings. That's so crazy. Can you talk about the, if you don't mind, if we go on to the Human Trafficking Capacity Building Center, something that is just sounds so amazing. Can you talk about that?
That is a project we have going with Booz Allen Hamilton, and that center really provides resources. We're there to train the trainer and try to make sure that any organizations who are dealing in human trafficking have the training, have the resources that they need to be directly helping trafficking victims. And we do a lot of research on that. Where a lot of our research and our expertise comes in is within the tribal communities. We have a very strong tribal program that we allow to work with that center quite a bit.
And could you just give us, our listeners, an overview of the National Center for Victims of Crime and what your mission is and kind of what your job is at the National Center?
Well, my job is the executive director. So I try to tell everybody else what to do. But usually, like a good servant leader, at least I hope a good servant leader, they end up telling me what to do most of the time. Our mission is really to help victims and communities that have been harmed by crime. And we do that through direct victim services. So we have several hotlines that we're constantly working that victims can reach out to. We also train a lot of police forces, a lot of district attorney's offices on how to interact with victims. And one of the things that we're looking at starting to do is really developing a strong research and innovation group to take all of the data we have, because we have so much data, and turn it into trend spotting so we can see what victims' needs are changing to and try to address those needs before they bubble up.
And you mentioned great groups that you train, but what I don't hear is judges. And I know that, I don't know if Laura's had the same experience, but as a law enforcement officer and expert and one who's trained many tens of thousands of law enforcement and related professionals across the country and around the world, that I ran into the issue that, the National Judicial College wants nothing to do with training, wants nothing to do with people from the outside helping to educate them. And Laura, I don't know if you've had the same experience.
I have, Jim. Certainly, I'll tell you, it's the favorite group that I would love to spend a lot more time with. When the coercive control law came in and the stalking law came in, they actually said they didn't need training when sentencing guidelines eventually came in because they're intelligent enough to interpret the guidance themselves. But unfortunately, with these areas, certainly when you're talking about psychological, abuse and crime and sexual violence, that you do need to have understanding of the psychology, the dynamics, that things aren't always physical, and about post-traumatic stress disorder, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, all these things that impact on a victim. And I was aghast this week, just to mention one case that happened in the UK of a nurse who was asphyxiated by a police officer in a car. Now, they had been having a relationship. Her name was Claire Parry. They'd been having a relationship and they were both married. And Claire had organized to meet with him. And when they were sat in this car, she basically sent a text to his wife saying that he was cheating on her. And his account was that somehow in the kerfuffle, in the melee, his arms, accidentally found themselves around her neck. And when he got out of the car, he realized that she wasn't breathing. And it was all very confusing. And then when police arrived on the scene, he stabbed himself multiple times with a penknife, but he said that she had done that. Now, the court case has just concluded, and he was seen to, well, his account was accepted, effectively, and it was dropped to a manslaughter charge. And the sentence was 10 years for him to serve 2/3. And the judge's comments were effectively that he put his hands around her neck after she texted the wife. Therefore, it was her fault. The provocation side to it came in. And we don't have a provocation. The provocation part of the defense was closed down in law some time ago. But the judge, a female judge, almost gave him the get out in her sentencing remarks. Now, we've asked for that case, the sentence, to be reviewed. Now, that's exactly the sort of thing that I'm talking about, that judges' interpretation and misunderstanding of what went on. And actually, Jim, if you saw this car, and I put a picture of it on Twitter, there's no way that he could be in the position he said he was in this kerfuffle or this melee, because the car was tiny. So even if somebody had just reconstructed and reenacted his account, they would have shown it to have been false.
Right.
But the judge took on the basis that he was a police officer, which somehow to me makes it worse, right? That he has no integrity. He killed her. He said that he was a liar in court, and he tried to say that it was Claire who attacked him. And so he discredited her in her own death. And yet still he's given such a ridiculous sentence. And that's a judge who should know better. But yet we see these sentences that don't reflect the crime and show me that the judge didn't understand that what he did was about taking control. He killed her to control her. It wasn't about a loss of control. And how his provocation defense, in essence, could be quoted in the judge's summing up, I can't even imagine how that feels to the family, quite frankly. To me, it's outrageous. And I've been tweeting about it on Twitter. And just yesterday, we got news that the case was going to be reviewed. But that's what we're dealing with all the time.
I think even beyond that, even beyond the sentencing and judges making those decisions, we have so many judges who are really not victim-centered, and they're certainly not trauma-informed. We have a civil side to our organization, which is the National Crime Victim Bar Association, which is plaintiff's lawyers, who are putting victims on the stand. And some of the horror stories of what judges will make them attest to while their perpetrator is sitting, staring at them, and what the judges allow them to go through. There just needs to be a lot of training, even on the very, very basics. I was actually, we leave so much up to judicial discretion in this country, and you're right, it's not trained on enough. When COVID hit, we were called for an opinion. Philadelphia had made the decision that all trials and all hearings were going to be live streamed on YouTube, and whether or not they would shut that down or whether or not a victim's testimony would be allowed would be completely up to a judge. So you have victims who are likely going to be threatened, who that is now going to be out there for the rest of their lives, and we're leaving it up to a judge to make a decision as to whether the victim can handle that or not.
Yeah, that's frightening. That's frightening, particularly when dynamics are misunderstood. Of course, in family law, the victim can be cross-examined by the perpetrator. I mean, there are certain things with cases just still blow my mind, quite frankly, that it's happening now. And I think a lot of the time, the public just don't realise how bad it really is. Of course, just to play the other card, because I was reading about the Larry Nassar case the other day, the female judge who actually created case law by allowing each victim to, even though he hadn't been charged in all their cases, but at the point of sentencing, to allow every woman that he had abused to give their impact statement, because she said, you deserve to be heard by me, you deserve to be validated, you deserve to be empowered. Now I would like that judge to be delivering training to other judges, right? Working with yourselves and Jim and myself, because then we'd really be making some fantastic progress for victims.
What did they call her? An avenging angel, I think was what she was called.
That's right. Yes, I mean, incredible.
As bipartisan criminal justice reform efforts gain steam across the country, most of them focused on the incarcerated, crime victims and their advocates fear their voices are being drowned out. And you might be surprised by what many of them have to say about justice for all.
How many of you remember the name of the person or persons you killed?
Inside the Louisiana State Penitentiary, convicted murderers are learning to own their crimes.
Who'd you kill?
Cornell Preston.
Jeffrey Owens.
But while these prisoners are talking about victims from the inside, victims' rights advocates fear they are not being talked about enough on the outside.
Do you think that victims have enough of a voice right now in this big conversation we're having about criminal justice reform?
I don't right now, and I think that's because for a very long time they were viewed as adversaries, not allies to reformers. When in reality, what most of our research is telling us is that we really should be allies.
One survey found that crime victims, by a 2-to-1 margin, prefer the criminal justice system focus more on rehabilitation than punishment. And most prefer shorter prison sentences, along with more spending on rehabilitation.
Most people will acknowledge that the way they are going to feel safe again is through rehabilitation of their offender.
I will always think of myself as a victim.
Susan Ingram also supports rehabilitation. In 2015, she was sexually assaulted by her massage therapist, who pleaded guilty to assaulting Ingram and 8 other women. Ingram spoke at his sentencing.
And I said to him, if God offers you a path of redemption, I hope you take it.
Ingram fears victims have not been given a seat at the table in discussions over prison reforms.
If it really is intentional that we want to do what's right and just for prisoners and for victims, there will be open minds.
Ingram reminds that life sentences are not just a burden for the incarcerated, but for many victims, too.
Do you think we talk enough about the lasting impact of becoming a victim?
I don't think that anybody, unless you've been a victim, can understand that.
Renee, tell us more about the work that you're doing with the National Center.
We have a lot of current programs that we are working on, and then we have a lot of upcoming programs. We talked about the police reform. We actually, one of the programs I'm the most proud of personally is our tribal program. So we have this tool, it's called the Tribal Resource Tool. What a lot of people don't realize is tribal victims in America are a very special population. The United States federal government owes them a trust obligation to service their victims for sexual crimes and violent crimes. Now, there's a split between the FBI, the BIA, and local tribes as to what they do, but they're just really a unique group because a lot of times people are also not culturally trained to deal with their belief system, and what their community means. So we've put together a tool. It is available online where if you are a victim of a crime and you are a member of a tribe, you can go and look by your tribe and find culturally sensitive services in your area, or at least the closest one that is close to you. Unfortunately, again, with tribes, a lot of times the reservations can be 2.5 to 3 hours from the closest city. So that closest resource might still be 2.5 to 3 hours away, but it's at least something. We're also launching a center for all tribal victims. We're calling it the Victim Assistance Center to Tribal Victims, which stands for VAST. And that will be looking at victims of domestic violence in tribes and other types of crimes so that we can best provide those services and be training advocates to handle those victims.
What are the kinds of things that law enforcement is insensitive to in terms of indigenous groups, tribal communities?
I think oftentimes there's a level of disbelief. If certain tribes do have certain ways that especially sexual assault cases should be handled as far as female to male interaction, most tribes, the woman is very sacred. So you do not necessarily want a man interviewing a woman for a sexual assault. There's also just certain cultural norms that most people are not aware of. And there are some 546 tribes, so it's very dangerous for me to try to group them all. And I don't like to do that, but generally a lot of times it's around cultural and faith-based practices.
Right. And what about work around domestic abuse and or stalking, Renee? Is the center involved in anything nationally or even locally?
We did have a stalking resource center. Unfortunately, most of our funding is grant-based, so it's cyclical. We had a 3-year work for a stalking resource center that is still available on our site, but it's not up to date. And it provides resources for victims of stalking and different information. I will also say that our hotlines handle a lot of stalking cases. So we do keep those active for victims of stalking to get advice, to get pointed to appropriate organizations to help them.
Can you say the hotline right now since we're thinking of it?
All of this information is available on victimsofcrime.org. So the hotline is called Victim Connect. And it's actually really cool because it's a chat service as well. So if you can't get to a phone at the time, if you can chat on the computer, we can service people that way as well.
And does that work with text as well?
We do have a text as well. Yes.
Great.
The national hotline for crime victims is 1-855-848-2846. So that's 1-855-4-VICTIM.
And what kinds of services do you provide with this hotline? What kind of a hotline is it?
Well, all of our hotline workers are victim-centered, trauma-informed. So they will talk people through whatever's going on if they're in the middle of a crisis situation. And then after that, they're trained to do warm transfers to a local center or to a local shelter and provide the maximum amount of resources that are close to that person.
And can you say what sort of percentage of calls you get in terms of, you know, how many would you say are related to domestic abuse or how many are related to stalking? Do you keep that kind of data at the moment?
We do, predominantly domestic violence.
Yeah, I thought it would be. And, you know, obviously our audience, by the way, is global. So we have a big audience in the UK, in Australia, in the US, and the UK has just gone into lockdown, the second lockdown. And of course, you know, being locked down with the abuser is hugely problematic. So when I was in the UK, I was helping service providers think about how do you talk with a victim when the abuser could be in the same room, the next room? Do you change your communication? How do you do the risk assessment when you've got people that are living in lockdown together and it changes things? And one of the things, Renee, that I was really, really concerned about was the number of murders of women in particular increasing across lockdown. And I don't know if that's something you keep track of here at all in America, but in the UK, I was tracking all the murders. And it was at my last count from the first lockdown, 38 women and 4 children who were murdered within a number of months, which meant we had 5 women every week, which is very unusual for the UK, whereas the US, you tend to have 4 women a day. And I know it increased across lockdown, but no one seems to have that data, which is very worrying.
And that's, we don't have the exact data, but you bring up a tremendous point of what we saw in lockdown was, for as wonderful as we think we've become with technology, it is still very much based on your income. So especially for all of our services that we offer, we always thought that we had a great way to reach everyone, not thinking that most people would access us from a public library for privacy. So when the libraries got locked down, they could no longer get to us. So they're living with their abuser. We saw a huge uptick in child abuse fatalities. There was one of the terrifying things in the pandemic, especially at the very beginning. There was a huge dip in child abuse reports across the nation. And that was because mandated reporters weren't having eyes on kids. And so it became very easy to isolate children. So most abusers were not bringing their children to the hospital until it was dangerously past too late. So there was this skyrocketing of fatalities, but a huge dip of actual reports.
My goodness, so worrying. It really is. Do you do much work around child abuse and children? Because I notice in your background, well, maybe you should tell our listeners about your background and where you started out, because that's, I was reading about you and very interesting as well. So I don't want to ruin it. I'd rather you tell everybody.
Well, I have been a little bit all over the place, but I did start as a theater major and left the theater to go to law school. And my initial goal was to be a child abuse prosecutor. And I do think that some of that was from my background. Frankly, my aunt did have 2 children and they were very abused. And I saw the long-term ramifications. So I did want to become a child abuse prosecutor. Unfortunately, the National Center has not done much by way of child abuse for probably the past 5 to 10 years, but that is coming back into focus for us as I've taken over. So I've sat in this role for about 6 months, and our chief program—
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. But our chief programs officer is actually a PhD in child psychology and a specialist in child abuse and child trafficking. So we are looking to spin back in because we now have the staff and the bench to really make an impact in those places.
And it's something that Jim Clemente knows a little bit about, isn't it, Jim?
Yeah, I've been involved in that a little bit. And I know you're aware of my history and also the fact that I have a strong commitment to trying to help prevent it as opposed to let people sweep it under the rug. That seems to be the historical perspective in this country, and hopefully we're getting away from it. There's a number of ongoing lawsuits against organizations like the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts of America. Certainly there have been major issues with coaches from the Olympics to major universities and doctors at major universities who are maybe crossing both those lines. The fact is that there are programs at the National Center for Victims of Crime that help other organizations that are trying to fight the good fight. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So we do have the Victim Policy Institute, which is our advocacy arm. It is an affiliate, but we work very closely with them and they do report up into us. They are fighting across the nation to flip child sex abuse statute of limitations laws. In 2019, they had a wildly successful year. They managed to flip four states, including New York and Arizona. And I'm excited about this, and this is hot off the presses. We're working together to look at some new cases in the troubled teen industry, which has been quietly starting to trend. Paris Hilton has come out and spoken against. And what the troubled teen industry is these schools where very wealthy parents send their children, and they're just hotbeds for abuse. And a lot of times, even when the teens are calling their parents and telling them these things are happening, the schools are coming back and saying they just want to go home. They just don't like the structure. Ignore them. Not all the schools are bad, but we are learning more and more about what they are doing. So we're looking at how we can advocate for those kids and get some regulations changed in different states.
Just a question, and it may not relate, but The Keepers, the documentary, did you watch that? And did it have any impact in your work and advocacy, the work that Gemma Hoskins is doing?
I did watch it. That was a tremendous movie in so many ways. It has not truly impacted our work. We were doing this work probably long before that movie came out. The Crime Victims Bar Association that I talk about, one of the founding members was Mitchell Garabedian, who was featured in the movie Spotlight. So the NCBBA has been fighting this fight for years as far as looking at each institution and figuring out how do we dismantle what they've done. We have filed in the past 2 years, I want to say at least 10 amicus briefs across the nation. We have one in Pennsylvania right now. There's a case called Rice versus the Catholic Diocese. The diocese is saying that she should have discovered that the Catholic Diocese knew that her priest was an abuser on her own, despite the fact that she reported the abuse to the diocese and sent them a letter. And as we know, they keep their records under lock and key, literal lock and key. And the diocese is saying she brought suit too late and she missed the statute, even though their watershed moment didn't come out until 2 years post the statute for her. And the diocese is comparing right now a child sex abuse victim's injuries to the injuries of victims in car crash cases. And they are saying that when you are sexually abused, you know immediately, as a victim of a car crash does.
That's obviously deliberately false bullshit. It that really aggravates me the most. I mean, I've heard stories from other survivors where the diocesan lawyers actually high-fived in the hallway once they got him to sign this non-disclosure agreement. They clearly want to shut the lid over this because they don't want people to know how bad they are. I mean, it's just outrageous. I don't understand how anybody could put up with that, how anybody could actually still be part of a church that does that. And they do it so blatantly. They do it with vigor.
And what's infuriating about this particular case is they're openly admitting it's all on technicalities. It's all on technicalities. And what's even more infuriating, if it could be more, she told the diocese it happened, and they told her that they had no evidence of this priest abusing anyone, or they told her that there was no record when they knew there was, and they are saying that it was her obligation to ask again.
That's
criminal. It's criminal. I just don't believe that they can actually say those things and still have the standing that they enjoy in the community. I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, I know that the church is filled with really good people, and they must be and should be disgusted by this kind of behavior.
I hope they are. I don't know. I will say that I am still a practicing Catholic, and I go to a very specific church for a very specific reason. And it's that the priest is the first person that I've heard from the pulpit say, this was wrong, and the church has messed up and continues to mess up. And I won't give his name because I don't want to get him in trouble with his bishop, but it was because I was on the verge of also leaving the church.
Just the fact that it could get him in trouble with
exactly,
this bishop is
exactly.
Disgusting.
This is vast right. Silence.
Right.
Vast silence.
I mean, Renee, it's so good that your priest basically stood there and made it very clear that the Catholic Church was wrong to do that. But I think it's the quote that really does resound for me, which is the cruelest lies are often told in silence. And it was Robert Louis Stevenson who said that. And I just think it's so important that people speak out. And certainly for victims, I just want to make this very clear that silence never helps anybody. It is all that it does is colludes with the perpetrator. And it's not your job to keep advocating for you. That's why what Renee's doing at the National Centre is so important. There are advocates there who can help. And there are advocates all around the world, Paladin National Advocacy Service, who can also be your voice. But please don't suffer in silence. There are others who absolutely understand what you're going through. And it's absolute nonsense for an organisation to turn around and say the onus is on the victim to keep going back, because we know that most perpetrators of abuse are serial perpetrators. And they will go on to the next victim, the next victim, the next victim. So it's really important that you do come forward and have your voice heard. So, and I just want to thank you, Renee, for the work that you're doing. I think we've only just really dug into a little bit of it. It sounds like there's much more that we could talk to you about. So it would be great if we can continue our conversation. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203-866-4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800-2000-247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.